Hi guys, welcome to the third MHP episode. My name is Sarah and I'm here with Jacob. And today's episode, we'll be talking about nutrition and sleep and the importance of a post-workout routine. Before we begin, kind of a controversial question. Is pineapple an acceptable topping on pizza?
Here's my thing. I really like pizza, and I've never met a pizza that's been improved by pineapple. So I've eaten
That's a really
pineapple
good
pizza.
point.
I eat it on occasion, but it's just a worse version of a good thing to me. That's my
Yeah.
opinion.
No, I
What are
totally
your
agree.
thoughts?
I totally agree. I mean, I'm Italian, so it's just never really gonna slide. Have I tried it? Yes. Hopefully my parents don't listen to this, but I've tried it. Yeah, it didn't make the actual food better. So I didn't really see the appeal because I think, like pepperoni pizza, I feel like that could make the actual pizza better, but pineapple kind of just adds this weird little sweetness to it that I think you can achieve with other toppings. So
100%.
that's our take. You guys let us know what your guys' take is on this. All right. So for the first question, right before we start, what are your thoughts on the importance of sleep and nutrition in an athlete's routine? And do you notice anything specific that athletes do that distinguishes them from other athletes in this specific routine?
Yeah, I think first of all, there's no questioning the importance of it, and I don't know if that's going to be news to a lot of people. I feel like that's something that's just preached all over the place. But my thing is, if it's something that you've heard and been like, yeah, okay, whatever, brush it off and move on, like it is something you should be thinking about and thinking about how each respectively could be better. But at the same time, you want to be careful about something called nocebo, which is, you've heard of the placebo effect, which is where you think something's going to be good for you, even if it isn't, it actually has a positive effect. And you can do the reverse to yourself, where if you had a bad sleep or you ate really bad the day before, and then you're thinking about how that's going to mean, oh, I'm going to perform bad today, you can actually just believe your way right into that being a reality. So my thing is, have a balance between prioritizing these things, trying to do them better, and then when they're not as good as they could be or should be, kind of mentally free yourself from that and just focus on the task at hand. And you know, it's kind of like tomorrow's a new day, try to do these things better the next time around, but don't linger with them, that's for sure.
Yeah, that's true. And I think it's also really good advice for the student athletes, because I feel like, especially in
Because it's never going to
university,
be perfect.
yeah. No, it's absolutely never going to be perfect. There's going to be the midterm season, the final exam season, and then there's also going to be the part of the season where you're so demotivated that you just want to, I don't know, sleep a lot, or you're super, super stressed. So it's definitely going to fluctuate. But I found something interesting through your notes that you wrote, I guess, 4 years ago now. You had said that at the peak of your two horrible weeks of sleeping and just chaos, you then had some of your three best workouts ever in a row. Do you have an idea of why this occurred? Is it a coincidence? And what can you tell to our athlete students when they decide to be more student athletes?
Yeah, well, for a little context, I was coming off of a back injury that was quite debilitating at the time. And I had decided once I could actually kind of move again, I would just use it as an opportunity to just chase a lot of hypertrophy, because it was like, I'm not going to be doing a lot of athletic things. So I was mostly in a hypertrophy phase through that kind of period of time. And first of all, I think hypertrophy is a little more resilient to some of these fluctuations. I think if I was training with a lot of sprints and jumps and throws and Olympic lifting and things that involve a lot of neurological stimulation and high force outputs, probably less likely that I have these great workouts after terrible sleep and stress and all the rest. But it also just goes to show, like, the it doesn't mean it's impossible. And I think having these periods of bad sleep and stress and bad nutrition, all the rest, it makes it less likely that your performance is going to be good on any given day. But kind of back to like, don't expect the worst. You can have these kind of miraculous, unexplainable, like things were really, really good for a few days and couldn't tell you why. Certainly, I certainly wasn't helping things a lot.
Yeah. I mean, I feel like, you know, it, as you said before, I don't think it's necessarily a surprise to a lot of the athletes and just people in general that sleep and nutrition is really, really important, which is why I know even at McMaster, the strength and conditioning coaches do a really good job also giving like a guide of when you should eat what. So, you know, you've worked at Forge. Did you guys have anything like that where you would kind of guide your athletes towards what, when they should be eating what? Or was it kind of just to their discretion or whenever they wanted to eat?
Yeah, I mean, at the professional level, there's an expectation that you are taking care of business on when you're on your own time. But I know, like, I wasn't in charge of a lot of the nutritional things. Actually, our goalkeeper coach covered a lot of these things, and I know he spent a lot of time thinking about, especially when we're traveling, where all the meals you're having as a team, they're scheduled.
That's true.
A lot of thought went into the timing, what's included, things like that. So, I mean, for someone that's maybe not at the professional level at the moment, just know that, you know, there deserves to be a lot of thought that goes into the quality, the quantity, the timing. And these are very complicated topics that don't have quick, easy answers. But
yes, that's very true.
You know, going in and crushing a pizza before the game is probably not the best idea. And the nice thing is a lot of stuff comes down to common sense. It's like, if it's a bad idea, you probably know it's a bad idea. So
yeah.
If you can just be aware of those things, it can get you a long way.
That's true. And, you know, I'm actually kind of surprised by how you said that, especially at the professional level, the athletes are kind of expected to know, because I feel like what's kind of advertised is that every single team has like a nutritionist and somebody that like keeps track and like, you know, makes sure that every single athlete logs their food. So at least to me, that was a surprise. But I was wondering, and this is, I guess, kind of a little bit off topic. Do you know if any of your athletes ever ended up eating a diet that was, I don't know, super unhealthy per se, and were still able to perform well? Or did you actually, do you think you were able to find kind of a difference between that? Or did you not even have access to that at all? Because I know as a strength and conditioning coach, you're not really able to like give advice on nutritional and diet plans.
Yeah, I think, well, usually where my role falls into is like giving the general advice, like, hey, let's do a little more of this, a little less of this. And then in terms of like actual nutritional guidelines, that things get a little out of my scope. But I think I would say, in terms of my own experience, it would be hard to tell if someone was thriving and doing absolutely horrid things to their nutrition, because you're not seeing all of that. Most often what happens is you see the dips in performance, you start to dig in, question why, and then you find some nutritional explanations, which I've seen a few times. But the thing is like, there's always going to be athletes that go out and do incredible things on the worst habits and routines that you've ever seen. And it's just, you know, some talent will just rise above those things. And they're not, you know, you see your favorite athlete pounding back Skittles and he's not winning because of the Skittles.
Exactly.
It's that the Skittles aren't enough of a negative factor to impact what he's doing. So it's good to get those things aligned in order in the way that we see them and think about them.
That's true. That's a very good point. For the second question, this kind of relates to muscle soreness. So I guess a post-workout routine. So there's this guy, his name is Dr. Mike. He is a professional bodybuilder, but he's also is a very knowledgeable individual that you seem to speak on and also read on a lot. And he ended up developing some type of technique that helps you avoid maximal soreness in relation to when you work out what. Obviously cannot be 100% of the time, but what are your pointers on this? And also for the audience, who is Dr. Mike?
Yeah, so Mike Israetel is one of my favorite sources when it comes to like hypertrophy, bodybuilding's type of training and advice. He's got quite a big channel and a lot of stuff out there, a lot of resources to consume, but maybe not a lot of stuff super transferable to the athletic population. But I'll say this, he's I think what you're talking about is his kind of method of keeping intensities low in the early stages of the program. And actually, fun fact, the thing you called out earlier about my three great training sessions, during that whole time, I was actually trying to learn his stuff, and I was actually copying exactly his advice and routine during that time. So I was on his program during all that success. So shout out to him. But I'll say, when it comes to an athletic setting, the easiest way you can think about soreness, and this also gets into making sure no unneeded injuries arise from training, is the three factors of novelty, volume, and intensity. Intensity being the relative effort of a thing. So I think this was maybe something I actually should have explained in previous episodes, but intensity doesn't mean, oh, I ran at 100% for 30 minutes and I'm exhausted and that was really intense. Intensity is, should be thought of in terms of force, velocity, like a max effort throw, a max effort sprint. And actually, intensity declines the longer an event goes on. If you sprint at max effort for 5 minutes straight, the intensity is actually going to be very low at the end of that 5 minutes due to the fatigue and the volume and all those things. So it's important to know volume is the quantity, intensity is the output. And then novelty is the third factor here. And when these things change, that's when soreness is going to increase, and that's when risk of injury is going to increase.
So do you mean that when something is novel, that's when the muscle soreness is going to be higher?
So that means a new exercise or a new variation, something like that. So the easiest way to think about this is, when one of those things changes or goes up, the other two should go down, or at least one of the other two should go down. So I use the example of, say you work up through a speed development program, and on week four, you're doing six sprints at 80% effort. So the intensity is 80%. The volume is six repetitions. The following week, going into week five, maybe it's a new phase where the intensity goes from 80% to 100%. Instead of keeping all the parameters the same, maybe you go from six reps to three. And then over the weeks following, you build your way back up and you end up back at six reps. But you don't start there, because by increasing the intensity, you're asking a lot more from the body. And if you just assume you'll be able to do a higher intensity with all the same volumes and everything else, not that it's a recipe for disaster, but you're just increasing the chances of something going wrong. So a conservative approach is to just scale the other factors back, so that you can push other things forward.
That makes a lot of sense. And by any chance, is this also related to the whole idea of deload and load when it comes to planning workouts, depending on what part of season you're in?
Yeah, I mean, when you look at in terms of a strength training context, you could apply the same principles. When if you're trying to push a strength-based area, you're going to make jumps in the load that you're using. And with that, you should see a drop in the repetitions, or some other parameter that's going to make it a little less stressful. And that's actually like the easiest method of progression. If you say, okay, right now I can do X amount of pounds for 8 reps, then you drop the reps down to 3, and now you're working at a higher weight than your 8 rep max. And then over time, you work with that weight and you slowly just add repetitions over time. That same weight, you go from 3 to 4 to 5. Eventually, you're at a point where you're doing this heavier weight for 8 reps, and boom, you've just progressed. And
Yeah, there you go. And a new PR.
exactly. So that's just like the easiest, simplest, cut and dry strength training progression you can approach. And then you would just knock the reps back down with some higher weight. And it's also a way to measure progress without ever having to do a 1 rep max. Or any traditional testing, because even doing something like a 1 rep max has inherent risks to it. It's not the most
Yes.
optimal thing to just throw at an athlete during the training process. So it's something I basically never use. And when I'm doing explicit testing, it'll be like a 3 rep max or a 5 rep max or something like that. But yeah, that's you should be able to see progress throughout just the training cycle
Yeah,
without needing
absolutely.
like a testing day or anything like that.
Yeah, absolutely. And of course, this progressions and kind of this improvement that you see through your athletes, how do you notice that? Is it through collecting data, or is it straight through performance during practice?
Well, I think I'm the biggest proponent that you should just be able to see and feel progress on the field, because if all of your measures of progress are in the weight room, you don't actually know that it's translating to things that are on the field or on the court. So I know like old school strength conditioning is like, we need the back squat to go up, we need the bench press to go up, and then we know that that's gonna make them better on the field. And it's like, yeah, sometimes, maybe, but best case scenario, you do great work in the weight room, and then you just look at what's happening on the field, and either things are looking better or they're not. And I know that's very subjective, but I think it's even more powerful from the perspective of the athlete. Like, do I feel like I could cover more ground? Do I feel like I can take more contact? Like, these things are, to me, much more important than my back squat went up 10 pounds. It's like, okay.
So it's relating more to the actual athletic performance, rather than like PRs that you were able to achieve in gym.
Yeah, and I think along the way, as long as you're tracking what you're doing, you can see, you can say, oh, I did this week, I just did 5 reps at this many pounds. And if I look back just 5 weeks ago, that was a little bit lower. So, as long as you should be keeping track of what you're doing, and then that should leave clues that things are progressing in the right way. But ultimately, I think most of the attention should be on how you're feeling, how you're performing, how getting feedback from coaches on how you're looking out there, and that's always going to be number one.
Yeah, very true. And relating this kind of to how you're feeling, especially after practice and a lift, foam rolling seems to be one very popular way that athletes cool down. For our viewers, before we even start this conversation, could you explain three easy reasons why foam rolling is important and why it's even used in the first place?
Yeah. First and foremost, reason number one is if you feel better after you do it, just do it. It's like one of those things where there's a lot of, and we'll get into it in a second, a lot of science behind why it works and why it doesn't work for other things. And it's like, if you stand up and you feel better, like that actually does count for something to me. So, throw it in the program and then don't think twice about it. But, it can also have blood flow benefits to increase circulation and get, fluids moving, which is positive. But I think the biggest thing for me, and the reason I always turn to it and explain it by, is the neurological tone. So a lot of people think that what's happening is you're breaking up all this tissue and you're causing all these changes to the muscle and the fascia and all the soft tissues. And in reality, all the looseness that you feel after foam rolling is based on the nervous system. What's happening is you're sending signals from the muscle to the brain, and then you get this reciprocal signal back that decreases the tension in the muscle. Because at rest, even right now, like if my arm has no soreness in it, or no, like it doesn't feel tight, there's a degree to which my brain is maintaining some sort of tone or tension on the muscle. That's just always existing. That muscle's never fully, completely like dead and relaxed. So what we're doing is we're just decreasing that, which then makes you feel like, oh, I'm looser. I've got all this new range of motion. The problem is, because it's neurological in its foundation, it's not actually changing anything. So an hour later, the next day, like nothing's changed. So my biggest thing is you should do it, and then you should go into some mobility work or into some exercise, because one of the biggest factors in when you're stretching and doing other things is it's that muscle tone that's biting you when you're trying to stretch and actually create changes to the length of a muscle or some other tissue. So you can kind of cheat the process by reducing that tone with foam rolling, and then doing something productive that's going to have long-lasting effects, unlike the foam rolling.
So would you actually recommend doing foam rolling before a workout too, and not just after?
For me, after is more of that, if it feels good, do it, great. If I'm trying to actually use it to target a specific area that maybe needs some work, then it would be the first thing on the program. You loosen it up with the foam roller first, then you go into some passive stretching, and then, as we talked about in other episodes, you go into some active work in those long ranges of motion, and you actually get the muscles firing in this new space that you've just freed up.
Yeah, and so, you know, I think that's a really good point, especially because a lot of people kind of believe that you just foam roll to foam roll. And I even notice, especially with like the younger athletes, they really struggle to do it, because I think the knowledge that you just shared is not really something that a lot of people know. And what do you think is the easiest way to just influence younger athletes from a younger training age to start foam rolling, so that you're able to actually see the benefits over a long period of time?
Yeah, you know what the best way is to destroy the myth that it should suck, because
that's true.
You see people get on a foam roller and they're wincing and they're like, and it looks like this terrible experience. And this was actually something I learned from Mike Boyle when I went, me and a buddy of mine went down to his place in Boston and did his certification. And he talks about how he always says foam rolling should never be more than a 6 out of 10 discomfort. And if you think about the things we just broke down in terms of how it works, and if a small dose, a small intensity of foam rolling allows the muscle to relieve its tone and relax, if you are giving it a painful stimulus, you're actually probably creating the opposite effect, where the brain is going into
loop.
It's going into protective mode, and it's like, I need to protect this area. Something's going wrong. And it can actually be counterproductive. So if you understand that it shouldn't suck, keep it at that six out of 10 or less, then you're probably just going to enjoy doing it more. And then you can actually more sustainably keep it as part of the routine.
I think that's really helpful advice. Yeah. And I really do believe that if people do kind of break up that myth of foam rolling sucks, which I think even sometimes when I was younger, I had it, like, especially when I would be rolling on my calves, it hurts so, so bad. And usually I end up just going down to just doing one calf at a time. I don't even put both on the roller because it just completely sucks. But at least this is helpful even with me, even just to understand why some people include foam rolling in their warm-up. Because I do believe that sometimes people believe warm-up is, you know, yes, you want to raise your heart, get yourself ready for the workout, but foam rolling is seen so much as just you're on the floor, you're going back and forth for 5 minutes, and it's, you know, seen as just cooling down. But as you just said, it's a lot more than that.
Yeah, and let me tell you that when I was in high school, because that was my phase of trying to take stuff from awful sources online and try to figure out a training routine for myself, I used to spend an hour foam rolling, and I'd be sweating and sore,
Yeah, it
and
takes a lot of work.
it was suffering because I was overdoing it, and I thought I had to hit every muscle. So by the time I did, all areas of the leg, and then I do my back and my shoulder, and like it would sometimes usually take me around an hour, and it would suck.
That's insane. That's like that's a
And
whole other workout after your workout.
right, and
Yeah.
if for the average person that's just trying to like make it a enhance their routine and make it part of the process, that's not sustainable. That's for sure. So
Yeah, you won't be able to make a long-term habit or routine out of that.
no.
You're just gonna start growing to hate it more. That's very true. All right, so before we wrap up today, I know that we had posted a poll up on Jacob's story. Did any questions come through?
I got one from Coach Dom. Shout out Dom. He's a soccer coach local that he's a very curious guy. He's always asking me questions. I like what
Good.
he's doing over there, but he asked about work to rest ratios and some resources around that. I don't have anything off the top of my head to point towards, but this could be an interesting topic to get into a little bit because it plays a role both in the gym and with the even skill components of things you might be doing, because you have to understand the intent of what you're trying to get out of the exercise and the various energy systems. Because if you are trying to get something fast and explosive, and I see this butchered in sports practices all the time, where the coaches are looking for some quick explosive action to be made in some specific setting, but they do the drill for 5 minutes straight, and then they go take a minute break, and then they're right back in it, and it's the ask of the drill is not aligned with the parameters.
That makes sense.
So understanding that you're really going to fall into three categories of you're doing something at a high effort for under 10 seconds with long rest periods, or you're going to be doing something that feels, I guess, what you would call traditionally intense or like fatiguing, in kind of like the 30 to 60 second range, in more of like a 1-to-1 work to rest ratio. Or you're looking at the other end of the spectrum where you're doing something for many minutes, but then that necessitates that the intensities are lower, and things like that, so you can actually get quality repetition. Yeah, that's something that gets lost sometimes, because I think back to when I was doing my own like working on my shot and practicing my skills, like there was no thought towards rests or how long the work should be. It would be I'd go till I was exhausted, and then I'd go sit in the corner, and then I'd be like, okay, I'm good to go again. And then as an athlete, if you can have some thought to like, okay, I want to be quick in this action, I'm going to make sure that I do three or four really high quality reps, and I'm just going to pace and walk and let the heart rate come down. Because I promise you, if you're actually doing something at high effort, reps 6, 7, 8, 9 start to look bad real quick. And
Absolutely.
either you're going to be doing low quality reps, or you're actually just cheating the intensity and you're not going as hard and intense as you think you are. So just build the rest intervals into it.
Well, thank you, Dan, for that question. And as we wrap up this episode, guys, don't forget to send in any more questions if you have them. We'll be happy to cover them on every single episode. Do not forget to give this podcast a follow. And I just want to thank you, Jacob, yet again for another great episode. And we'll all see you guys next time.
Thank you.
Bye,
See ya.
guys.